The following sermon is brought to you by thepreachersvault.com, bringing old-time preaching to a new generation.
We have come with open hearts. Oh, let the ancient words impart.
All righty, so we're in Mark chapter 5, again verses 21 through 43. It's a rather large context, and we read through it on Wednesday night, just read the whole context, and then backed up and started breaking it down just a little bit. There are four different places when you study through the Gospel of Mark. There are four places where Mark kind of begins an account, a storyline. He gets partway through it, and then he, in the way that he pens things, he interrupts himself, or at least allows his writing to be interrupted. It's because Jesus was interrupted. But he inserts something else, and that's exactly what he does here. This happens to be the first of those four times, but here we have an account that starts off in verse 21 where we have a man named Jairus that comes. He's a ruler of the synagogue, and we'll mention that again a little bit later. He's listed in verse 22. And he comes and says, "My daughter is nigh unto death." And we talked about on Wednesday night how serious that was. That was that she was at the absolute point of death. And he was talking about eschatology or that sort of thing, the day or the moment of last things. And so he had no doubt in his mind that death was imminent, death was coming, but yet his faith was still great enough to come to Jesus and to beg of Jesus, to besought him, verse 23, King James speak, greatly asking him to come and see his daughter that she may be healed and risen from the dead. And that's what he desired for Jesus to do. Now, that's verses 21 to 23. And then suddenly in verse 24, as Jesus is moving from one place to another, as he's moving toward the house of Jairus, he is interrupted. And that's because there's a woman who we do not have a name for her, but verse 25 says she was a certain woman who had an issue of blood for 12 years. We talked a little bit about on Wednesday night what that may have been, what that medical condition may have been, and the fact that that issue of blood was a very severe thing that had come upon her. Of course, bleeding for 12 years, it really wouldn't matter what it was or what type of bleeding it was, it would be terrible. But in this case, it was some sort of a female, if we want to call it that, type hemorrhage, actually. And so she had really, really struggled. It tells us about her that she had suffered, quote, many things. From many men, those who had attempted, who had tried to heal her, to try to find some sort of solution. Nothing at all had worked. And we mentioned on Wednesday night how that even today, that same condition, if it be the same, I think that it probably was, at least something very similar, was completely incurable. And so no matter what she had done, it even mentions that she had spent all the money that she had trying to do that over the course of that 12 years. She was getting no relief. And so when she comes to Jesus and is immediately healed, as she was, simply by touching the hem of his garment, that's a very impressive thing. That's just amazing. And I know that that not only obviously changed her life, and we'll talk about in both ways that it did, physically and spiritually, but it must have just kind of blown the minds of all those that were around about him. So we'll back up and pick up some of that in just a moment. Now, I think about, and I looked up a few things. When you think about diagnoses in the medical world today, you can be diagnosed with just about anything. You realize that? And we've got all the normal things we think of. We might spit off a list and say, well, you could have a cold, flu, virus. You could have COVID. You could have cancer. You could have some sort of a bone disease. You could have a heart disease, and you list that out. But I just did a little bit of digging, more or less for entertainment, but it was very entertaining, and looked up what is known as the IDC or ICD-10. Now, if you're not familiar with the ICD-10, what that is a listing currently of over 140,000 medical codes that can be put in by your doctor or some hospital that can be written in it. Basically, it transfers over to your insurance. And so it's billing codes is what it is. And that list about 10 years ago only consisted of 18,000 codes, but now there are 140,000 of those. So that really breaks things down and divides things up. And I just happened to jot a few down just to show how difficult it is today for us to specifically diagnose anything. Now, I'm not saying there aren't plenty of diagnoses. There are, but you might say someone has this or this or this little minute thing or this. There's so many variants. So just a couple of these. One of them is a code that is written in that ICD-10. It is W22.02XA. W22.02.XA. What that is a diagnosis of is walking into a lampstand. So if you walk into a pole in the street, that's the diagnosis they'll write down. If a little bit later in the day, that same day, and it would have to be the same day to qualify, you would walk into the same lampstand, it would be W22.02XD. So instead of A, it's D. Now you hit it again. You turned around, well, I guess walked out of the emergency room, slammed in the same lampstand. But that's a real legitimate codes that are listed because they divide things up. This one here I really thought was strange. I don't know how they come up with it. But it is V91.07XA. And this diagnosis describes that you have been burned by a pair of on-fire water skis. Don't know when that's happened, but they have a code for that. And then this one here, I hope none of us have ever been diagnosed with, but who knows? This is R46.1, and it stands for Bizarre Personal Appearance. And so if you ever digging through your online portal and you see W46.1, you're probably going to be upset. But that's just the types of things. That just illustrates that in our day, with technology as it is, yes, we have discovered many things, but putting specific diagnoses on something that really matter may be more difficult. We may have overcomplicated things. But in Jesus' day, they had worked hard to try to do something to heal her and were not successful. Now, we read through that. We really spent most of our time on her account then. The question was asked by Jesus, "Who touched my clothes?" in verse 30. His disciples turned and said to him, verse 31, said unto him, "Thou seest that the multitude are thronging thee, and sayest, Who touched me?" They're kind of being rhetorical. Why would you ask that? We've got an entire multitude. Luke's account tells us the throng of people were there on him. They had thronged him. They had completely wrapped him up. Matter of fact, Mark uses the similar word or the same word back up in verse 24. But why would you say he touched me? Now, Luke's account, and I was just kind of reading back through this today, trying to pick out a few things this morning, and I realized reading it, Luke's account tells us specifically that Peter said this. Now, Mark says the disciples, and so I don't argue that they all had the same thought, that's for sure, but oftentimes Peter, in situations like this, happens to be the one that comes out and says it. So that seems to be, if you put the two accounts, something that we discover there. But nonetheless, she was healed. It said in verse 33, we were looking at this as we closed the other night. It said, "And the woman, fearing and trembling, knowing what was done unto her, came and fell down before him and," quote, "told him all the truth." And that's the principle there to learn. I've got the word key, K-E-Y, written out beside that. It's a principle to learn that in order to be healed from our sin, if you want to look at it from the spiritual side, these physical things teach spiritual things, look at it from our sin, in order to be healed from all our truth, we're going to have to tell the truth, or all our sin, we're going to have to tell the truth about who we are and have those sins then to be washed away in baptism, and or later be willing to confess our sins to be forgiven as we repent of them even after baptism. And then verse 34 that was interesting to me, "And he said unto her, Daughter, thy faith hath made thee whole. Go in peace." And we mentioned that word peace. It says it's being in the state of peace, meaning you're fixed now in peace. You can hold on to this peace. Go in peace and be whole of thy plague. And the word plague was used twice. That same word can be translated as scourge. And that brought up a few parallels we were closing with as well on Wednesday night, that she and Jesus were the only two in the Gospel of Mark to be said of as being afflicted. And this is the word right here, afflicted, scourge, or plagued. That she and Jesus Christ are the only two people in the Gospel of Mark that said is suffering, and then she and Jesus Christ, the only two to be said to have blood flowing from them. And I had references for those also on Wednesday night. Now, kind of picking up now where we left off. Again, this story, this account line is broken. So you have to put verses 21 to 23 together with, we'll just push out of the way the one with the issue of blood because we examined it, but put it together with verses 35 through 43. So 21 through 23 and 35 to 43. So let's read through that again, pick up on a few things and then examine it. Again, the parallel accounts, if y'all didn't, I think I actually reversed these on Wednesday night as far as the exact specifics, but it's Matthew chapter 9, this first section about Jairus' daughter. It's found in Matthew chapter 9, verses 18 to 26. So Matthew 9, 18 to 26. And then Luke's account is Luke chapter 8, verses 41 through 56. So Luke 8, 41 through 56 are your parallels for this particular part of the account. But verse 21 of Mark 5, "And when Jesus went and passed over again by ship to the other side, much people gathered unto him, and he was nigh unto the sea." Now, if you're tracking this thing out, Jesus has made an excursion across the sea here a number of different times already in the account. Basically speaking, Jesus would go on one side of the sea in Capernaum on one occasion. He goes over on the side toward Capernaum, works that area. He determines that he's going to go to the other side, which puts him over in the Gadarene area on the other side of the Sea of Galilee there. And as he gets there, that was really found the first part, the first 20 verses of chapter 5. He heals that man, or those two men, Matthew's account says, but the one man Luke mentions or brings out, Mark mentions or brings out, that had those legions of demons, and he heals them. And as soon as he does that, the last part of that, of chapter 5, verse 1 through 20, the last section of that, basically once he casts those swine, or casts the demons into the swine run off the steep hill, the people then in turn tell him to get out of our town. They don't want him. And so even though he's done such a great thing for this man, cast out all these demons and I guess put them to death in the sea or something along with these swine, even though he's gotten them out of the town, he has basically killed their swine. So they're upset and they say, get out of our town. So a great thing is done, a wonderful thing is done, and people reject him for that. They're not willing to look at the basic wonderful thing that he'd done in the healing. They're overlooking that because they are more materialistic and they're more mourning what was for them. And then when you get into verses 21 through 43, our context, it starts out by telling us he went back to the other side again. So they say, get out of our town, move on, just, we don't want you over here, you've killed our swine, just get out, pack yourself and get out. And Jesus listens in this case. He moves back across the sea and basically comes back into the area which would have been in and around Capernaum, more of his kind of home base as we often refer to it, and here he gets an entirely different reception. The people on the one side, 1 to 20 around the Gadarenes, they're saying, go, get out of here. Take your stuff, take your disciples, and just go. As soon as he lands back on the other side, barely gets up on the shore, the throngs of people come to him, and Jairus, being the first one, says, come. Come on. We need you. This woman that gets in the middle of the crowd, basically, she hears of Jesus somehow. She gets in the midst of that crowd, and her mindset is, all I need to do is get to him. I need to be in his presence. I need to be there with him, and he will heal me. She was confident in that. But it says that he was on the other side of that sea. And behold, verse 22, there cometh one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus by name. And when he saw him, he fell at his feet and besought him greatly. So he's down on his feet, or down at his feet, I would assume prostrate on the ground, and it says he's begging him greatly. And the statement that he makes is, my little daughter lieth at the point of death. I pray thee, which is another way of it illustrating he's begging here. Come, that's the first request. Lay thy hands, that's the second request, on her, that she may be healed. And third request, that she will or shall live. And Jesus went, and much people followed him and thronged him. Now, you have to jump from verse 24 over to verse 35. And while he spake, that is, while this man Jairus, Jesus, and the multitudes there were speaking and speaking to the woman that had just been healed, and while he spake, there came from the ruler of the synagogue's house a house a certain which said, "Thy daughter is dead. Why troublest thou the master any farther?" Now, that's what was suspected was going to happen according to verse 23, but guess what happened? She is now dead. Could that have been seen as disappointing to anyone there? I think the people who came and ran to him, at least from the house, I think the servants, whatever they were, other members of the synagogue who ran to him, I think they were extremely disappointed in that. That's right. And he had been waiting, or he had been delayed in getting to Lazarus for 4 days, seemingly by choice. And their initial reaction to that was, as you didn't hear that, if you hadn't heard that, can't talk this morning, if you'd only been here, he wouldn't have died. And so this man runs to him and interrupts him. And his answer is basically, my speak is, quit wasting your time. You don't need the master anymore. It is too late. And in the context here, as you just mentioned, we haven't even read it yet, but he's going to take that mother and father and carry them in to be a witness. He's going to take a part of his inner circle, his friends, Peter, James, and John by name, in there and allow them to personally witness. But guess what? It's still on the outside. The throngs of people. The multitudes of people. Now, the woman who had come with the issue of blood, she came there in spite of the throng. She came there and said in her mind, and basically as she reported it back out loud to him later, "If I can only touch the hem of the garment, I'll be healed. That's all I need. I don't need to talk to you. I don't need you to lay hands on me. I don't need you to do anything special. I just need to touch the hem of your garment." That's her way of looking at things. But I think, this is pure subjection, so I'm admitting this, I tend to think and believe that the whole throng of people are coming because as soon as the ruler of the synagogue, one of the rulers of the synagogue, Jairus, who would have had some level of authority in that place, no question about that, as soon as he comes up and the word comes across, "My daughter is nigh unto death," I think that's when the throngs jump on. Now, they had seen miracles. You can back up through the pages. They had seen miracles, even Mark's account. A number of miracles had already been taken care of. For example, just in the previous chapter, chapter 4, he had protected his own disciples from danger. That's when they went out on the sea and they were about to be all killed because of the storm that was out there. He had protected some men at that point. We've already looked at them, those taken on by the demons from the devils. He had taken hold of this woman from disease, but now he's kind of upped it up a notch. This is death. This is potential death. And so it seems the throngs of people came in because they wanted to be a witness to that. They wanted to, in my mind, I'll put it my way, I want to see if he can pull this off. And so they make their way down there. They get to the place. And then verse 35, again, the man comes up. He spake to them in the ruler of the synagogue's house, which is a synagogue's house, a certain... "Thy daughter is dead. Troublest the master no further." Now, have you ever said something like that? And what I'm thinking about is the way that we think about ourselves. Have you ever needed the assistance, needed the help of God? Maybe in a few occasions, if not many occasions, you've gone to God in prayer. You've begged of God to help you in some situation. And then you get to a place where you're like, okay, nothing has seemingly happened yet. I may as well give up and not bother him anymore. Maybe you feel like your prayers are doing no good. Or maybe we'll take it outside of these four walls. We'll take it to someone out in the world who's never even obeyed the gospel, someone who's lost. But maybe they get to a place in their life where they're struggling, where they need help. And maybe we as a Christian have gone to them and said, "Hey, look, I absolutely know through this book right here, I absolutely know where you can find help. Where it nothing else can ever be healed on you. Your sins can be washed away. You can be forgiven of those things. And spiritually, you can be completely made whole. I can help you with that. I can show you in Scripture where that occurs." And what might be their statement? "Not me. It's just too late." You know, I've lived this way my entire life, and I've done so many things throughout my life that is so terrible. There is no way that I'm going to even try to bother God with this. He won't do anything. He won't help. It's just too late. They urged the man, they urged the crowds of the same. They urged Jairus of the same. My daughter is dead. Why troublest the master? And watch verse 36. And as soon as Jesus heard the word that was spoken, he saith unto the ruler of the synagogue, be not afraid, only believe. So he hears what's happened. He hears that discussion. He knows that their mindset is just leave him alone. It's too late. She's dead. There's nothing he's going to be able to do about this. Maybe if he hadn't have been interrupted, maybe somebody added, I don't know. Maybe somebody said if he hadn't have been interrupted by that woman right there, maybe he would have made it. But it's too late now. Just leave him alone. And Jesus in turn replies to that when he heard it and said, be not afraid, only believe. You'll put that in other terms? Jesus said, you need to trust me. The woman, preceding woman, issue of blood, had obviously trusted Jesus far above what anybody else had been able to do. All those physicians, all those men who had attempted and tried to treat her, those 12 years, every penny, every dime that she spent that had been unsuccessful, she comes and she trusts Jesus. Now here we have this father who is standing there, Jairus, and Jesus says, be not afraid, only believe. You just got to have faith. Now that's sometimes our answer, right? When we're struggling or when we've got a loved one who's struggling, when they're dealing with a hard time, what have you, that's sometimes our answer. Hey, look, you just need to have faith in God. You just need to trust God with this. Is that easy? No. It's not easy. But the only way to improve or to ease that is to build our faith with the only resource we have. What's the most common verse we would use in this context? Romans 10, what? So then faith cometh by hearing, hearing by the word. We've got to listen to God. In this case, he had to pause and he had to listen to Jesus. Now, he had other people here who said, look, it's too late. Leave the master alone. Your daughter's already dead. I'm assuming there were probably some of the multitude of the crowd that was there who had been walking along excited to see what he would do. Maybe some of those turned around and said, oh, man, I hate that. We do know what happened. We know at least what was happening when they got back to his home because it's revealed to us. And he, look at verse 37, and he, that is Jesus, suffered no man to follow him save Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. And he, that's Jesus, cometh into the house of the ruler of the synagogue and seeth, watch the next few words, the tumult and they that wept and wailed greatly. Is that to be expected? A loved one passes away. It would be a very rare case if at least some people or most people in the room would not be upset. And especially, I've just seen this through experience, if you're dealing with a child. You know, not to take anything away from it, but if someone passes away who's in their 90s, who have lived a good life and have been sick for a long time, and it was somewhat expected. Sometimes people, they look at that and they say, well, you know what, I'm just glad they're gone to the reward, you know. And we have different perspectives, different, not that it's not upsetting, not that it doesn't cause us to grieve, but you take a child, the reaction's so much different in general. And what is stated here is that there were people there who were wailing. There were people there who were bringing up what was called a tumult. Does anyone have a translation in their hand looking at, let me get back to where I was at. 38. Is the word tumult in there? Where did I get tumult from a minute ago? You jumped up and moved. In the middle of 38. Oh, yeah, there it is. I had a migraine all night, so my eyesight's not good on top of everything else tonight, today. And he came into the house, and the ruler of the synagogue seeth the tumult, and they wept and wailed greatly. What does it mean to have a tumult? First of all, how many of us used that last week in our discussion with a great friend? Not any. Tumult. Confusion. As a matter of fact, other translations put that as confusion. Uproar. That's a good idea, a good way of thinking about that. An uproar. Turns them upside down. They're just all over themselves. It says in addition to that, some of those descriptive words, that there was a tumult there, that they wept and wailed greatly. And he, Jesus, when he was come in, saith to them, why make ye this ado? Or confusion. And weep, the damsel is not dead, but sleepeth. Now, here's something that perhaps and most likely was going on. Not that people aren't naturally upset when a loved one is lost. Not that people are certainly not naturally upset when a 12-year-old is dying, or in this case has been reported as dead. That's certainly the case. But in Jesus' day, in kind of the Jewish tradition, especially someone here who is being called a ruler of the synagogues, they often hired wailers or mourners to come in and assist with this. They were just people who were basically professional mourners. Now, I don't know if you've ever been to a funeral where, how do I word this? It almost seems as if that some people are being exaggerative. Is that a word? Are going overboard. You know, you've seen the people, and I'm not saying this can't naturally happen, but people just dropping to the floor and rolling. And I've seen people be extremely upset. That's kind of what's going on here. It is said that most people, and this was considered to be just a common person, would have had, by standard, tradition now, we're talking tradition here, would have had two players of the flute and then one wailer. You know, there's a difference between moaning or something and wailing. Wailing is that cry, that's that outpour, that's that extremely loud, that's what gets the attention or draws attention. Two flute players and a wailer was tradition for even the poorest of people. We've got a leader of the synagogue, a ruler in the synagogue. Perhaps there were more. It was enough that Jesus looked at them and says, look, you're making too big of a deal out of this. Everybody in this room needs to get out. The damsel is not dead, but sleepeth. Now, is she dead or not? She was nigh unto death, across the page here, point of death, verse 23. They report that she is dead, verse 35. And then Jesus comes in and says she's not dead, she's just asleep. Is somebody wrong? Well, somebody would have to be if we took all those terms as we take them today. Again, you look at the parallel of Lazarus found and recorded in John chapter 11. And in that case, that's what Jesus said about Lazarus. He's not dead, he's just asleep. They're like, well, he's been dead 4 days, he stinks. No, he's just asleep. Jesus is speaking in a term or in terms that are illustrative of something common they said. It's kind of like us using, I could look at someone and say, well, they are dead, they died. Someone else may look at that same person, maybe lying in a casket, and say, no, they passed. Say, we use that more commonly. No, she passed away, or he passed away. Is that the same thing? It's a softer way of saying that. Yes, Nick?
Is it 1 Corinthians that Paul says, you know, it's because of your sin that many of you are sick and some have fallen asleep?
Mm-hmm.
And it, you know, it's clear from the context he's talking about these people have died.
Yeah. That's yet another instance. Paul said in 1 Corinthians, yes, that's exactly right, where this is often used as death. But here's the thing, all that aside, for Jesus in his power, if she's dead, she ain't dead for long. He has the ability to raise her up. He's going to raise her up. He's going to have that. Now, We can know something, and this is where I really, really love, and I always try to emphasize the context. Not only the context we have, and by the way, I remind you, in Mark's account right here, Mark chapter 5, verses 21 to 43, is the longest, most drawn-out account of this, which is strange. Typically, Luke's going to be the longest, Matthew's going to be second, Mark is going to be third, as far as the shortest of this, the most brief. And Mark is moving immediately. He's moving straightway with his account, so his pace is quicker. Less details are often given. Luke, being the physician, however, concerning sick people, and in this case a dead young lady, is generally going to have some detail. Luke gives us a detail. It was said she's nigh to death. It was said she is dead. Jesus says she is sleeping. Look at what Luke does. Put a marker right here in Mark chapter 5 and go back with me to that Luke account, which is going to be Luke chapter 8. So don't go back. Go forward with me. Matthew, Mark, Luke. Go to Luke chapter 8. And the accounts are very close in their parallel. There are only very few details that are given. I mentioned one earlier. Luke reports that Peter is the one that speaks up and makes the statement about this, about the daughter who had the issue of blood. Peter's the one that speaks up and says, hey, we can't tell who that was. There's no way to know who touched you. But look down here. Let's begin the reading in verse 49. That kind of gets these parallels running together. And while he yet spoke, he cometh one from the ruler of the synagogue's house, saying to him, thy daughter is dead, trouble not the master. That's pretty much the same wording even. But when Jesus heard it, he answered him, saying, fear not, believe only, and she shall be made whole. So here Luke gives us just that little more detail. Just not only believe, but just what you're going to believe. He illustrates she's going to be made whole. She's fine. Going to be fine. And when he came into the house, he suffered no man to go in save Peter, James, and John, and the father and mother of the maiden. And all wept and bewailed her, and said, and he said, weep not, she is not dead, but sleepeth. Still running parallel to the other account. And they laughed him to scorn. We hadn't got to yet, knowing that she was dead. So they're laughing because he says she's not dead. They're laughing, she is dead. But look what happens. And he put all them out and took her by the hand and called, saying, maid, arise. And here's the key, verse 55. And her spirit came again. And she arose straightway and commanded her, and he commanded her to be given meat. That's the key phrase. And her spirit came again. What does that mean? She is dead. And I get sometimes people have those experiences. They say, well, I died 9 times on the operating. I don't argue that from a physical, from a medical standpoint. People's hearts stop. Activity in their brain sometimes slows and different things happen. No argument there. But a person is not dead spiritually, biblically, until what occurs? Soul leaves the body. Who tells us something about that? James tells us that. So look at what James has to say. Go to James chapter 2. James chapter 2, verse 26. Of course, James is illustrating something differently. He does mention a physical fact, however, to parallel a spiritual truth. And James says this, James 2, 26, for the body without the spirit is dead, so faith without works is dead also. So what James reveals is a spiritual truth. Truth is truth no matter its source. James reveals that when the body no longer has the spirit, that's at the point when real true death has occurred. The spirit is left. Back over in our context of Mark, Mark doesn't reveal that. He just said she was told to get up and walk. He just says, tell her, go take her over here and let her eat. She's probably hungry. Plus, by the way, eating proved oftentimes that these people were real and not just what they would have thought as an apparition or a ghost. But Luke told us specifically there, again, back to Luke's account, that her spirit came again unto her. Why even bring that up? Because the accusation could have been made by everyone there, well, she wasn't dead anyway. She was just, and even Jesus said it, she was just asleep. We might say, well, she was just in a coma. She just had a really high fever and passed out. Whatever the situation might be. Not what we're told by biblical truth. Not what is revealed by inspiration. She's dead. Completely, fully, biblically, spiritually, physically dead. But yet Jesus raises her up. And they laughed him to scorn, verse 40. But when they had put them out, he taketh the father and mother of the damsel that were with him and entered into the damsel where the damsel was lying. And he took the damsel by the hand and said unto her, Talakulami, however you say that, which is to be interpreted, damsel, I say unto thee, arise. That's where you can insert verse 55. And straightway the damsel arose and walked, for which she was the age of 12, and they were astonished with great astonishment. And he charged them straightly that no man should know it, and commanded something should be given to her to eat. Now, there's a whole lot there. We're obviously stopping, the bell says we are. Still a whole lot there left that we could mention, but one of the main things to bring out is the fact that when they saw these people that were able to go into the inner part of this. We got Jesus, we've got Peter, James, John, we've got the parents. But they're astonished. When she stands up and arises and walks, I just assume walks now where the multitude can see her. I don't know if she went and looked out the window or anything, what happened, I couldn't prove. There's astonishment on top of astonishment. And that's that megos astonishment that we saw way back over in chapter 4. When we were learning of the disciples, that there was a great storm, and there came, verse 39 of chapter 4, a great calm. So now it's great astonishment or amazement that comes in here. Any questions or comments? Thank you for your time.